worry no sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, beardos? Welcome to episode 70 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we'll talk about what we've been eating and then dive Scrooge McDuck style deep into the mailbag to answer listener questions and comments.
Before we do that, Paul.
Yes, Andy?
We got a little bit of an announcement. It's a ways off, so we'll probably say it once now and then remind people as it gets closer. But, Paul, what's going on?
So we've been graciously asked, both Andy and myself, to speak at a VegFest event. Unfortunately, I will be the only one that will be able to attend it because Andy will be probably halfway across the country. But it is May 13th, the Delaware Action for Animals 9th Annual VegFest. That's a Saturday. From 1 to 4, and it's at Banning Park in Newport, Delaware. So super excited about that, super excited to announce it, super excited to do it. So, you know, hopefully if you're in the area, you'll be able to come out and you can say hello and listen to me talk.
Yeah, that's I wish I could be there, but I am very excited for you to do that, Paul.
I wish you could be there too, Andy. It won't be the same without you, but I'm excited nonetheless.
There'll be a lot more math involved.
It'll be solely math.
What if you just teach a math lesson?
And then just acted like nothing was unusual about that.
Yeah, you have to send them an email that's like, so how big is my chalkboard going to be?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. So yeah, that's exciting. Exciting, exciting stuff. Speaking of other exciting stuff, Andy, I know you've been eating some good stuff. Where have you been and what have you been eating?
Paul, I was in Phoenix, Arizona, and what brought me there was the PHX Vegan Food Festival. It was my first time doing it, and it was their second year in existence. And they had, I believe, over 3,000 people. The VIP thing sold out.
Wow.
And yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a really great day. Definitely will be returning to this fest. And a lot of beardos came by to say hello, a couple of returning beardos, but there's some new beardos as well. So thank you to Madison, Meredith, Justin, Sheila, Mike, Dustin, and I'm pretty sure it's Tess, but it might be a J. My handwriting's really bad. So Tess and or Jess, I'm sorry, it's been a minute since we met, but thank you all for coming out. It was awesome to meet you and great to get pictures with everyone. And appreciate all the kind words everyone said about the podcast. So thank you to all the beardos that came out. And while I was in Phoenix, Phoenix has a bunch of pretty cool vegan options. And I returned to Green, which seems to be quite beloved in the community there. And it's a place that I like. You can get healthy stuff or you can just get junk food there. Their claim to fame, I think, is the Big Whack, which is a vegan Big Mac. And I went the healthier route. I was treated to a fantastic meal from Beardo Meredith, who reached out and said, hey, let's get a meal together, and coaxed me out of my hermit crab shell, and I came. And I got the Dagobah Jungle Bowl. So already props for the nerdy reference there, but this bowl had, it was like mixed greens, so salad base, and on top of that salad base was tortilla chips, or strips, I should say, and a big pile of jerk-seasoned fried Brussels sprouts.
Ooh, I like the sound of that.
Yeah, it was quite good. I was very pleased with this meal. And, you know, I went to a bunch of places. There's pictures on our Instagram from them. But the place that really stood out was a cafe that I stumbled upon. And then I think someone at the fest recommended this to me. And I can't remember who it was for the life of me. So apologies if it was a beardo out there. But the Udupi Cafe, which is an all vegetarian Indian place. And I got the Gobi Manchurian. And it was incredible. I'd say it's probably like the best thing I ate all weekend. And, wow. You know, it's just like battered and fried cauliflower chunks in like kind of a spicy sauce coated in. And I've had this at several other places, but they did it so well. So definitely got to give them a recommendation.
Nice.
And the one last thing I will mention, a few days ago, I made it to Los Angeles, California, the vegan Mecca, and returned to a few places I love already, including Donut Friend. And the reason why I went there was to get their new creme brulee donut.
It's the star of our Instagram account, I feel like.
People are loving the hell out of that. I posted a little video of me like turning it around and kind of showing it off. Donut Friend is like one of those places, kind of like Beyond Sushi, where if you post a picture, everyone loves it because it's colorful and interesting and very exciting. So I didn't go wild. I didn't get like a dozen or a half dozen to eat for a long time like I normally would, but I got this one, and I also got one that was like strawberries and like whipped cream, like a cocoa whip kind of thing.
Ooh.
But this creme brulee donut, it's very impressive. You know, they torched the top of it, so it's all crunchy, and then it's filled in the middle with the creme brulee. So highly recommend Donut Friend. They are a friend of mine indeed.
Any interesting facts about Phoenix or Los Angeles, Andy?
I got nothing. I got nothing for you, Paul. I don't need to set the picture. People know what LA looks like.
All right. I don't. I've never been there.
All right. Let's move on. A preamble to the mailbag. We have some notes from the corrections department from the last couple of episodes that have accumulated. Genevieve B. wrote in about our Segan episode, and in it we were talking about the authors of Segan Eating, and I had said that I believed that they were the ones who coined the term, and something in the interview had led me to that conclusion. But woe is me for not actually looking into it. Genevieve said that they had heard this term on a podcast back in 2012, 2013. I did a little more digging. I found it used as early as 2007. So they did not come up with the term, but the authors of this book, but they are certainly capitalizing on it.
And I wholeheartedly believe everything that Andy says, so I just went right along with it.
And then just a few quick notes. Batter and Crumbs, we talked about from the Philly episode. They do not actually have a storefront. They're just available via several different wholesalers. And I'm not even going to list any in case I make a mistake there. But they're working on it. I hope they get one. And Freakin' Vegan, I had said, was from New York City. They're actually from Prospect Park, New Jersey. So for anyone keeping track, consider those facts corrected.
They have been corrected.
All right, with that said, let's dive into the mailbag, Paul.
Let's do it.
Because the mail never stops. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. There's never a let-up. It's relentless. Every day it piles up more and more and more, and you've got to get it out. And the more you get out, the more it keeps coming in. And then the barcode reader breaks, and it publishes clearinghouse
debt. All right.
When you control the mail, you control information.
This first one just says pineapple on pizza.
We have gotten so, it warms my heart, Paul, that people seem to immediately think of us when they think of the pineapple on pizza debate.
Yeah.
We get tagged in things all the time now. The president of Iceland made some statements about pineapple on pizza, and so many people sent us that article. I don't know if there's really anything to talk about there, but wanted to acknowledge that we appreciate all the pineapple on pizza love and hate that has been directed towards us.
The crusade continues.
Yes, indeed. So thank you to everyone that has been keeping us abreast of any pineapple on pizza news that has been happening around the world.
So our first actual question, Aaron T. through our email, and also Caesar_Rivers on Instagram, both asked, what's the name of our opening song?
So the opening song is by Dead Prez. The song name is Be Healthy. And Paul, we have not discussed this at all, but when we first started the podcast, we're like, we need a song. Well, this one's about veganism and really like Dead Prez, so let's use it. I've been thinking lately, as the podcast has grown, I'm wondering if it's time for us to create our own original theme song.
Ooh, I'd be down with that.
I feel like as we grow, like, we're not monetizing the podcast, though we may, you know, we would like to, and we keep talking about this, make shirts and stuff, and then we are still making money off of it, so it feels weird to me to have, like, a song that, you know, they're not making money off, they're not making that sweet, sweet podcast money along with us, so.
Yeah.
I bring this up because I'm curious to see what everyone listening thinks about that. Like, is this song so inextricably tied with the podcast? It'd be weird to change it over. Do you think it's time that we make our own thing? Paul is a musician, so.
And so is Andy.
That's
what I would say about people saying I'm a musician, though, too.
Anyway, so that is the answer to that question.
So our second question comes in from Rose P. What qualifications must bloopers and end theme songs meet to end up in the episode? Can you shed some of the editing magic on us? Is it an involved process? Give us the scoop. Needs more bloopers, always. I don't know if I read that with the proper inflection, but I put my own inflection on it.
So I should say, we will be getting some deeper questions as we go along, but it's always fun getting questions about the mechanics of the podcast. For anyone that does make it to the end of the episodes, I know sometimes they're quite long, our closing theme is different every episode. And so anyone that's been a keen listener has hopefully picked up on the fact that any song that ends the episode has some tie to something within the episode. And sometimes it is a very obvious tie, and sometimes it's just some weird offhand phrase that someone said that made me think of a song. Or like the other, like last episode, I think Paul just happened to mention The Man Trapped Under Ice, and I was like, done. So that's really all the qualifications are for the ending theme music to get popped in there.
And then I feel like sometimes we just say like the word ducks like once or something, and then Andy Googles ducks ska song, and that's how we find the ending songs.
Often I'll think of like, oh, this very popular pop song would really relate, but I need the reggae version of that, so I'll just be like reggae cover of Britney Spears or whatever, just to get a little different. You get a little insight into our musical tastes through the music that pops up at the end, but sometimes it's just some random song that I've pulled via on Spotify, just typing in the words like Seganism and see what pops up. Oh, there's the Seganism theme song. Let's use that. As far as bloopers go, I don't know if we have any specific criteria other than something that struck me as funny and probably doesn't add to the actual conversation at hand, but still would be amusing to someone to listen to. So those get thrown down at the end of the episode as well for anyone that makes it to the end for those little Easter eggs, those vegan Easter eggs. All right. So Amy G wrote in via email. I appreciate you guys bringing up the recent news article about the USDA purging its website of animal welfare information. I would have loved to hear some sort of call to action for listeners to follow up these issues. Something like, you can call the USDA at 844-820-2234. I assume that's their actual number. I didn't actually give it a try. And let them know that you want the USDA to restore the pages immediately. It got me thinking that I'd really like to hear more things that we, the listeners, can do in our lives to address all of the topics that you guys discuss. I love the podcast, and the topics you guys talk about are things that I don't hear about often, but that I think are extremely important. Having a specific idea or two of how I can do something differently in my activism life would be really helpful. So, Paul, I think that's actually a pretty good suggestion. What say you?
Yeah, definitely. I think in the future we can try to think about more of that kind of stuff, more suggestions. I think a lot of the times we just kind of, you know, we're responding to an article or we're talking about an issue, and we have not, like, we're you know, working through the articles or the ideas as we're recording the podcast. So it's like we don't always have these fully formed ideas or what to do about them in a situation like this. So this is like a great suggestion. I think sometimes we just don't think of stuff like this at the top of the, or while we're recording it, but you know, it's always good to, if something like this ever happens again, of course you are welcome to email us or comment on the Instagram or comment on the Facebook page, like with something like this, like, hey, you know, you can call the USDA, and I'll probably be like, hey, I didn't think about that. That's a really great idea. So, definitely if anyone out there thinks of something that we didn't think of, we're always more than welcome to hear about it.
Yeah, I think this is a great idea. I think we often get kind of caught up. A lot of what we talk about are, you know, I think we give suggestions in the form of, hey, this is how we think you should talk about this particular issue. this is how we think it's good to be intersectional in your approach and all that things. But it's rare that we're like, hey, the Bullnose Ray call is happening right now, and this is the organization that you can call. So I think a lot of that will come in like news stories when we're talking about less abstract ideas. But Amy, I think that is an excellent point, and we will make sure to make an effort to do more of that moving forward.
Cool. So moving on to the next one. This is from Herbivorous Lion on Instagram, who asked, suggestions of podcasts or YouTubes and such that put on regular vegan content that you listen to? Question mark.
So I think Paul, is it safe to say that you don't take in a ton of vegan content?
That is safe to say.
Yes. I also, people often ask me, like, what other good, you know, vegan podcasts should I listen to? And there's like a handful, and I know we've mentioned a lot of them on the show before. You know, a lot of them just don't really pull me in and grab me. But I made a small list of vegan content creators via, you know, YouTube and podcast that I think are good, I think are worth checking out. And if most of them, if you're a fan of the show, I think it'd be a natural progression to check them out. And some of them I just think are really fun resources for veganism. So on the podcast side, obviously, we're going to mention Vegan Warrior Princesses Attack. They're great. And of course, we've done a few crossover episodes with them. If you are looking for interviews with other vegans, the Witch Side podcast is great, like W-H-I-C-H side podcast. They're coming at it from like a vegan anarchist perspective, and they have such a wide range of guests, so and a huge back catalog. So you can find everything from people that are engaging or advocating for legitimate direct action to people that are just doing vegan education and kind of everything in between. So that's the Witch Side podcast. And then a podcast that I did and that I started listening to, the Tegan Goes Vegan podcast, is another interview podcast. And it's really cool because it kind of feels like someone that's newer to veganism, and they're just there to soak up whatever knowledge their guests have. It's kind of, I think, a really interesting way to approach these types of interviews. Like, it's not like the show is trying to get any specific point across. Again, she interviews a wide range of viewpoints on the show, and is typically pretty intersectional in the interviews that I have listened to. So that's Tegan Goes Vegan. So check that out. And then on the YouTube front, Paul, you and I are both big fans of The Vegan Zombie.
Oh, yeah.
I will actually just put on The Vegan Zombie videos while I'm doing stuff because I find them so entertaining. It is a vegan cooking show. It's a post-apocalyptic vegan cooking show and all the fun that comes with that. So, Vegan Zombie. Paul, you are a big fan of The Vegan Black Metal Chef.
Yep.
The Vegan Black Metal Chef has a cookbook out, but also has these YouTube videos, and was actually interviewed on our show way back when we first started, somewhere within the first five episodes, I think. So
yeah,
you knew that. And then finally, A Privileged Vegan is a really great YouTube channel that, if you like our show, you will definitely like that, because it talks about a lot of the same issues, often way more well thought out than we are doing. But Privileged Vegan did a really good dissection of the unnatural vegan intersectionality video that we had a whole episode dedicated to. She has done a couple of, you know, videos, follow-ups and whatnot. So I hope those can be a good starting point for people. If you're out there and you have a podcast or whatever that we didn't mention you think would kind of fit in with these suggestions, please send us an email, because I'm always looking for new content. It's just rare that I seem to find one that really kind of speaks to me in the way that I would want it to.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy.
All right, Paul.
Yes.
This one is another Instagram question. Comes from @CrystalKaleChips. What are your feelings on farm sanctuaries who pay for their rescue animals?
I think it's tough, because it's like, obviously you want the animal to be in a better place, and in a farm sanctuary, it is pretty, you could be pretty confident that, they are in a better place than where they were before. However, it's like, I think it is not great necessarily that you are, I guess, supporting whoever formerly had that animal, because whatever they're doing is probably not so great. And in the grand scheme of things, this probably isn't going to end like the cycle of whatever's happening. So in that sense, I think I don't feel so great about it, even though it's like, yeah, you'd rather see this one animal in a better place in a farm sanctuary, but doing that is, you know, kind of supporting the continuation of whatever bad stuff is happening.
Yeah, I had a roommate once that purchased a rat from a like commercial pet store, and she was vegan, and she said she did it because she wanted to save the rat, because otherwise the rat would have been used for food for another animal. And I get that impulse, like I can purchase this animal and save this animal from whatever horrible life they would have. And I don't think that that's necessarily not a noble thing to do, but you know, again, like you were saying, Paul, I think you're just perpetuating that cycle. Like, for instance, an animal sanctuary that purchases, you know, a bunch of chickens. And then if the money is then going to that, you know, animal agriculture operation so they can continue their operation, then to me, that feels like you're just kind of putting a very, very low adhesive Band-Aid on the situation. I've heard of cases where someone has just straight up like bought out like a mink farm, and so the mink farm is no longer in operation at that point. And I think that is kind of a nice middle ground.
That's pretty sick. Things.
Yeah. So I like that, but in general, I feel like there's enough animals to be rescued from other situations that farm sanctuaries shouldn't have to rely on purchasing animals. You know, every situation is different, but I think my general overall opinion is that it is not helpful.
Yeah. I think it's hard to like give a flat out answer. I think it more depends on the as most things do, like the context of the situation.
Yes.
So moving on, another one from Instagram from @Resoline. I recently learned that the turkey was considered for the national animal of the U.S. Ben Franken wanted them to be. Do you think that if turkeys were a symbol of nationalism, they'd still be eaten as much? I'm going to go ahead and say yes. I think that they would be. I don't think that people care enough about animals, unfortunately, to be like, oh, but this has like a symbolic meaning, so I'm not going to eat it. I think that people care much more about like, wow, this turkey leg tastes good. Nom, 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 nom. So unfortunately, I do think that they would still be eaten just as much.
Yeah, we did not discuss most of these questions in advance, so I wasn't sure how you're going to answer that. I think it would be reasonable to assume they would be held in higher esteem, but I also think unless they are animals, whatever the animal might be, that are in our homes and a part of our families in the way that dogs and cats and some level rabbits, et cetera, are, I bet turkeys would continue to be exploited. And who knows if it would be like, hey, it's Thanksgiving and we have to eat the national animal now. Like, I could see it going that way as well.
Yeah. I was going to say something similar. Like, I think obviously we're talking about this weird hypothetical situation, but if way back in the BF days, the Ben Franklin days, like if it became the national animal then, and then the culture of how we view turkeys changed over time, I think that might've changed something. But if tomorrow the national animal became the turkey, I don't think that would change anything.
Yeah. And side note, I feel like if Ben Franklin was an animal, he would be a turkey.
And we're done with the mailbag episode. I think we've answered the most important question, and we'll see you next week.
Picturing a turkey like out in the storm with the kite and like the key tied to it,
and those goofy ass glasses.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. All right, so our next question comes from Yasmin Musa, 96 from Instagram. Recently discovered your podcast and absolutely love it. Hard eyes emoji. I listen to it while I train at the gym and it's great. Strong arm emoji. My question is, what is your opinion on zoos? Also, I love emojis. I know some are terrible, but some do a lot of conservation work and have animals that are severely endangered.
Sorry. A lot of people's emails have also included this wonderful praise for the podcast, which we greatly appreciate, and I have taken them out. I don't know why I left it in there. Thank you. Thank you, Yasmin. I know Paul appreciated reading off those emojis.
I did.
I don't know if we've really explicitly addressed zoos on the show. I know this is for probably a lot of people out there that are seasoned vegans, something that's kind of a settled issue. So I guess we should just put our two cents in so people know where we stand. I am against zoos in pretty much every form. I think captivity is cruel. And to me, it presents, when people talk about conservation, it presents a false choice. It's like when people say, well, we have to eat honey to preserve the bees, as if, you know, preserving bees necessitates that we take this product of their labor. I don't think that conserving animals necessitates that we put them in cages to be gawked at by humans for profit. I think that there are much better ways to conserve animals and for people to learn about animals as well.
Yeah, and I think in some cases it's like the type of thing where humans have caused these animals, some animals at least, to become endangered. And now we're saying like, oh, but now we need to do this to save them. It's like we have caused the problem, you know, so it's like the fact that there is a current problem shouldn't be the excuse for further exploitation because we are the one that has caused the problem. And does that make any sense? That idea sounded better in my head.
I'm sure someone could say that, you know, many of us would view, say, spay or neutering an animal is kind of violating their fundamental rights and is perhaps a speciesist tactic, but we've got ourselves in this situation, so we have to do something about it. So we're willing to accept that in order for the greater good. I feel like someone could compare it to that in that situation. Like, we got ourselves in this mess, so we got to have zoos. But again, I think that, you know, zoos are not necessary and, you know, their primary function is to create profit. It is not to, you know, help animals.
True. Very true.
And, you know, if you go back to one of my favorite interviews, I believe it was episode 10 with Doomy Bay, who is, he went vegan while he was incarcerated and he made the connection and he talks about how, you know, as far as people say we're learning about the animals, he's like, how much can you learn about a human by observing them in prison? That's not what is natural to them. And obviously you can learn about human nature under those conditions, but that's not really, like, you wouldn't really say, we need to learn about humans exclusively from what they're like when they're incarcerated. So I think that they have very little value above and beyond making money for certain people.
Agreed.
So we got an email from Jennifer L., which was a couple-parter, and we have gotten a lot of very long emails from people, which are always awesome to get. So some of those we've broken up, and I've tried to respond to anything that we're not going to answer on the air via email, but Jennifer sent us a YouTube link, which we'll put in the show notes, of a Kia commercial that aired during the Super Bowl that involves activism, sort of, and was wondering what our take on it was. Jennifer said, I feel like it portrayed activists as quote-unquote crazies, and therefore the cause is unimportant and easily dismissed. Do you feel like this ad has a negative impact on the way the culture perceives activism and therefore veganism? And so this commercial, we're not going to play the audio because I don't think it really conveys what's going on, but it stars Melissa McCarthy, who is driving in her vehicle, and it's a series of her getting phone calls saying, getting information that says the whales need saving, and then she goes off on like a Greenpeace style boat, and she's in the little inflatable, you know, boats that zip around. I know how boats work. And then like a whale jumps out of the water and lands in her boat, and it throws her, you know, through the air, and she hits the ship, and then it's like, oh, the icebergs need saving, so then she goes to the icebergs, and the icebergs melt, and she, you know, falls through this big crevasse, and then the rhinos need saving, and she's like, oh, the rhino. It's just a series of her going through these horrible ordeals. So I hadn't seen it until Jennifer had sent it to us, and I thought it was worth talking about just a little bit. Paul, you watched the video?
I did.
What do you make of this? Is it just a bit of fun? Or is this something that is going to sort of negatively impact the world and negatively impact activism in general?
Well, I think it kind of like trivializes activism a little bit. Like, it kind of just makes it seem silly and like comical. And I think it makes light of a lot of the very important work that people are doing, you know? And also, like, there's this... it kind of also puts forth the idea, like, I don't know. I just think overall it trivializes not only the work that people are doing, but just like the passion that people have for this work as well, and makes it into that kind of, like that stereotype of like, someone told me I need to do this thing, so like, I'm going to go do it. And it's like, I don't really care about it. It's just like a thing to do, you know? So I thought it wasn't great. I don't know how harmful it was, but I was just kind of like, that's kind of annoying.
Yeah. For me, my problem with it was less that, like, I feel like there's room to maybe laugh at ourselves. Obviously, this is not like a bunch of activists that made it, but to me, what was harmful about it, because, I mean, essentially at the end of the video, the conclusion is basically activism is really hard, so why even bother going and doing all of that stuff when you could just buy this Kia that gets 43 miles per gallon? You're going to save the earth that way. You can buy your way into saving the planet. You don't have to go engage in all these things that are going to hurt you and are silly and frivolous anyway. All you have to do is buy the right car or buy the right light bulb or get this type of bamboo floor mat, and then that's all you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So the verdict is in. We do not like this Super Bowl ad, and we think you feel totally justified in feeling a little miffed by the whole thing. Obviously, this isn't like the biggest issue in the world that we need to go protest about, but I think you should certainly feel vindicated in feeling that something was off about this ad.
Yeah, I don't think it's like, you know, the worst thing in the world, but it definitely, I think, was not great. All right, moving on. So Meredith writes in, I know your disdain for PETA, and believe me, I totally get it. But for all their faults and continuously poor judgment, they do have a knack for raising awareness through petitions and letter writing. I haven't found another group that can push information out to the masses so quickly and efficiently. With the push of a button, I can auto-populate my information on their petition and hit send. Also, I've heard you say a few times that animals are not ours to do X, Y, Z, and that is precisely their mission statement. Do you think there's some middle ground there to be friends? Can we be friends with PETA as an entity?
Well, first let me say this is Meredith who took me out to lunch, so thank you once again. Hello, Meredith. So I don't think that, like, literally every single thing that they do is bad, but I think that the fact that they have become the face of veganism for, you know, most of America, if you think about veganism, if you know about any organization related to it, it's almost definitely PETA. Maybe it's HSUS for some people, but for the most part, PETA is the face. And so the fact that they kind of continually do these really horrible stunts, you know, I think that they should continuously be criticized. And I guess my position on it is, I'm glad that if they're going to continue to exist as an organization, they will continue to do these more low-key things like working to get more vegan options on college campuses and, you know, alerting people to things that are going on with their Fast Action Network or whatever. But I don't think we need to, like, be enemies with people that work at PETA, but I think we need to continue to hold their feet to the fire whenever they do something that is messed up.
Yeah, I forget what the correct expression for this is, but the conundrum is that, like, I think they are so popular and they've attracted so many vegans or animal advocates because they do these really high profile, what we consider mostly problematic things. And it appeals to people's emotions, I think. And that's why people that are looking to do something, they say, like, this is how I'm going to do something. Like, this is going to be my thing. Like, I can yell, I can be loud and be bold and do this thing that's going to attract a lot of attention. And that's very appealing to a lot of people. So I think these high profile things are the reason why they're popular. So I mean, I want to say that the middle ground would be they just stop doing those things and do the more low-key things like what you were just talking about, Andy. But then the problem is going to be, it's like, would they be as popular? Would they get as many members? Would they get as much funding if they didn't do those things?
I think that they could easily find ways to do high value publicity stunts that don't involve the messed up stuff.
Have they ever, though? Or I should say, can you think of one off the top of your head? I shouldn't say have they ever.
Nothing comes to me immediately, but I think that they could do so much good if they focus their energy on different types of campaigns or different tactics within the campaigns that they do.
Yeah. Well, maybe they're listening, and maybe PETA, the entity, is listening, and PETA will change their mind. And
like, I don't know, they put out a video, I think it was them, where they, you know, had people testing various milks, and they're like, oh, that was dog milk after the fact, and people are like grossed out by it, and like, you know, it's like prank show style, but it's not like relying on sexism or anything like that.
Yeah, there you go.
That can get viral videos, and I don't know. I have faith that they can do it.
The middle ground.
Yeah. So anyway, to answer Meredith's question, it's like, yes, I think that we can personally be friends with people that work at PETA, but I also think that we should never stop holding them accountable for what they do. And I have no reason to, you know, turn to them if I'm looking for an organization to support, or if I'm looking for an organization to point someone else towards, or like, hey, I want to go vegan, you know, I wouldn't send them to one of PETA's web pages. I don't think that they're worthy or deserving of that.
Agreed.
Aaron G writes in via email. And again, that email is thebeardedvegans@gmail.com. Aaron writes in, how do I get past the notion that I'm being hypocritical when it comes to expressing my newfound views on this lifestyle when having discussions with non-vegan friends and family? It was not long ago that I would eat anything and everything without thinking twice and was known as a foodie among my closest friends, so I can't help but think that they are judging me now when we go out to eat and I make a suggestion to try a dish that is vegan. I know that it shouldn't matter what they think, and they do support me taking a vegan lifestyle, but I don't like thinking that they are probably thinking that I'm full of shit and this is just a phase I'm going through behind my back. I know I can certainly relate to this. Paul, what do you think about this whole situation?
Yeah, I think it definitely, this is like one of those things where you know your friends, like you know how to communicate with them effectively. You know how much you're able to like push them and give them information and stuff like that. So I definitely think it's one of those things where you want to read the room, as you say a lot of times, Andy, and kind of just like feel out how much you're willing to talk about and totally admitting, like, you know, admitting, like, or at least not trying to hide the fact, like, that, you know, you ate meat just a little, like, not too long ago. And I guess trying to explain to them, maybe something like trying to explain to them, your thought process and what you, because I'm sure most people have some conflict. It's like, wow, this tastes really good, but like, oh, this might not be the best thing ethically to do. So maybe like explaining to them your conflict and your reasonings might help. I mean, I don't know if you, obviously it could be too much and you don't want to like push people away. Not to say it's bad that they're being exposed to this information, but you know, like I was saying, just kind of feel out how much these people, like your friends and family, like how much you can talk to them about it, or, you know, if it comes up, talking to them about it. But yeah. That's what I have to say.
Yeah, I think that this is something that kind of only gets cured with you continuing to be vegan and sort of proving people wrong if that is indeed the thoughts that they're having about you. You know, but as far as like feeling like a hypocrite, I guess someone could frame it like that. But for me, it's like, oh, you learned some information and then you changed what you're doing because of it. Like, to me, that's not hypocritical. You know, it's like sometimes people say they value politicians that never change their stance, but I would rather someone that is willing to change their position. You know, I don't think it's like a noble thing to be someone that says they've held the same position for their entire life just to say they've held the same position. I think it's a noble thing to be able to take in new information and change. I don't think it's hypocritical at all. I think that it is to be viewed as a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think. And I know we've talked about this before when, like, I think it came up when we were talking about using graphic images to advocate for veganism. And we talked about, like, people that will just, like, vegans that will just, like, look at these graphic images or watch these graphic videos, like, daily or, like, weekly just to, like, remind themselves why they do this and as kind of, like, repentance type thing. And I definitely don't think that that is, you know, beneficial to your advocacy or to animals in general, to kind of, you know, feel guilty about, like, you know, formally eating meat, because I mean, for most of us, we've been raised in a culture that strongly promotes eating meat. So, and it's like, it's the type of thing where it's been given to us since we were small children, since we were born, when we didn't even have a choice about it. So it's just like, I think that it's not worth feeling, you know, hypocritical or guilty about, because, you know, you can't change what you did in the past. Like Andy said, you learned information and you changed and you move forward from there and you try to be a better person. All right. So next up, Abby writes in, I'm just now listening to episode 58, and I was surprised when Andy referred to dressing up your dog as exploitative. I know the comment was an aside to the issue you were discussing, and to be fair, I'm not finished the episode yet, but obviously it really caught my attention. Perhaps there are people who dress up their dogs in regalia that is exploitative in that it's restrictive or intended for a forced performance, but I honestly do not feel that most people who dress up their dogs, myself included, do so largely for reasons based in practicality. All this is to say that most of what she wears is rooted in purpose. The whimsy is just an aesthetic bonus. I take good care of her to the very best of my ability, and her comfort is utmost on my priority list, as I would say it is for most human companions of pets who exhibit the pet or person behavior that I do. As you stated, there are plenty of people who treat companion animals As you stated, there are plenty of people who treat companion animals abysmally. So I guess I'm wondering what the harm is in what I'm doing, particular between vegans.
So episode 58 was, do single issue campaigns perpetuate a harmful animal hierarchy? I don't remember my specific comments, but I think speaking to this issue, I think that people who are, you know, parents for animals out there, I think that dressing your animal up, and especially in the way that Abby is talking about here, it's hard for me to really see it as like harmful, but I also think it's silly for us to not sort of acknowledge that, yes, a lot of what it is and that added whimsy is something that we like, is something that does something for us. And obviously there's something different, you know, if you're just dressing your dog up in like a Halloween costume, that is something where you're purely turning your animal into entertainment. I'm not going to lie and say I don't think it's funny when I see a picture of a corgi in a lobster costume. I think it's hilarious. It's hard for me to see as there being a lot of harm there. But I also think this kind of goes back to our conversations about how, you know, we kind of have to accept that we are not all as 100% anti-speciesist as we might like to think we are, that there are certain things that we kind of allow because, you know, we don't see it as being too much harm and we see ourselves as being pretty benevolent. I would never give someone a hard time if, you know, the clothes that their animal's wearing, if it's for an actual purpose, happens to look pretty cool or looks funny, whatever it might be. I think it was, as Abby suggested, it was just kind of a quick aside. So I don't, to me, that's not my flagship cause, but I guess just to, you know, explain what I meant there, assuming if I'm thinking about what I think I'm thinking about, that is what I meant.
I'm going to counter that though, Andy, because don't we do the same thing with babies? With human babies?
You know,
babies?
Paul, you always bring up babies whenever I talk about animals and entertainment, and you know I'm not a baby fan, so...
Yeah, but right, it's like we dress babies up, and like if I had a baby, I would be putting like goofy sunglasses on them all the time.
Yeah, I mean, okay, yeah, a child probably needs to wear a shirt, and if it just says like,
no, but I'm going beyond that, like, you know, if I put a clown wig on my child or something. A clown wig and oversized glasses, it's like that would be hilarious, and I don't think that people would find that like, as long as it's like, haha, look at this, and I take a picture and post it on Instagram or something like that, and it's not like, haha, look at this, and then I like sell the rights of my child to some advertisement company to use, you know, it's like I'm not profiting, as long as I'm not like profiting off it, I don't think there's necessarily that much harm in that.
I'm not arguing that there's harm, but I guess what I'm saying is you're obviously using this baby for your entertainment.
But
I don't think it's not going to scar them for life, but you have to acknowledge that you are doing something to this child that they are not necessarily agreeing to just for your own entertainment.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. We're talking about this more than the importance of it probably garners, but I don't know. I don't see as much of a problem with it. I understand what you're saying about kind of like the underlying idea that animals are ours for entertainment, like, is possibly there. Whereas with babies, it's, I guess it's not there as much, maybe. But
I mean, with clown wig, oversized glasses, McGoo over there, like, that's definitely that's definitely falling into the realm of what we're talking about. And again, I think it's super low on this. Like, if we were to have some kind of harm hierarchy, it's like, it's at the bottom. It's like ground level, floor level. I don't think, you know, but I'm just saying, I think that if we're being honest with ourselves, we will admit that some of the things we do for our animals are for our own entertainment.
Yeah. I think I would agree with that.
Okay.
We can move on.
Okay, Paul.
Yes, Andy.
It's a big one.
Uh-oh.
Pete W. emails in, "My ethical question is whether it is still okay to listen to Morrissey. His music has introduced millions of people to animal rights, and he has never shied away from calling meat murder. Unfortunately, his comments and pronouncements on animal rights have been, shall we say, in quotes, unfortunate. And he sometimes sounds like a PETA campaign come to life. These comments share many of the same problems we see in PETA, a tone deafness that puts animal rights above any other issue, not to mention objectionable comments about other countries and cultures and their treatment of animals. Can I still listen to the Smiths and Morrissey with a clear conscience, or do I have to put them on a pile with Woody Allen and Roman Polanski, never to be seen again?" So, Paul, this kind of is a question that is both very specific, but also in a broader sense, it's sort of asking, can we separate art from the artist? So what do you think about this? And I should say that I am not a Morrissey or a Smiths fan, so I bear no emotional attachment to this issue whatsoever. Paul, are you a Morrissey fan?
I am like barely a Morrissey fan. So I do not have that much attachment to him either.
So What does this line look like for you where it would mean yes or no on supporting Morrissey anymore or not?
If I was a big Morrissey fan, I would probably still listen to him, like, given all this stuff. I think there is only like one or two bands that I can think of right away in my life that I'm like, I am never listening to this band again because of things that the members of the band have done. And I think my line for that is, I don't think he has crossed that line where I like am just never going to listen to him ever again, or I would never listen to him ever again. I think it's unfortunate, but I mean, given the multitude of music that we listen to, I think most artists probably have views that we disagree with, or like that we would view as problematic views. Especially like pop artists. I feel like a lot of them are just not great people. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like a lot of them just aren't great people. So, I think we can be critical, and we should be critical about these objectionable or problematic views, but we can still enjoy the art itself. I think for me, you know, it's like there's a line for me, and that wouldn't necessarily cross that line. And obviously that line is probably going to be different for other people. I don't know. What are your views on it, Andy?
Yeah, I think that everyone's going to have a different line. I know there's like certain issues that are kind of near and dear to me that have caused me to stop supporting certain, you know, YouTube or like, you know, vegan personalities, figures within the movement that has me immediately write them off. You know, there was the person that kind of inspired my "some vegans are fat" button and the fat happy and vegan thing, you know, was someone who said, you know, if you're fat, you're telling the world you don't love yourself and all that stuff. And to me, I was like, all right, I don't need to support this guy. But I also don't really begrudge others for supporting him, even though I guess I maybe give him like a little bit of the side eye, but like, you know, I understand that are certain things that will like, you know, touch a nerve with me that won't touch a nerve with other people. So I think it's important to be critical of our darlings and to, you know, be willing to admit that they have faults. And beyond that, I think it's just sort of, it's going to be up to you. Personally, Morrissey is not someone that I feel like supporting. But if I was a lifelong Morrissey fan, I'm not sure where I would stand on this, you know. But, you know, I saw Manchester by the Sea and thought it was amazing. And then I posted about it and someone's like, hey, did you know Casey Affleck is a fucking creep? And I was like, I didn't. And now I just am like, how can I support him? You know, so it's just one of those things where you're going to have to, I know you've come to us for advice and we're just telling you, hey, what do what you want to do. But it's just one of those things where you have to decide that for yourself. I think that it's probably better to not support him, but I also understand why someone would continue to. And I guess just to say here, Paul, we've gotten a number of emails and comments and questions about certain things, asking, essentially people sort of asking us, is XYZ culture appropriation? Is XYZ racist? Should I not support this thing anymore? And as, you know, two white guys, I think it's 100% not our place to ever give a stamp of approval in these situations. I think that, you know, we could certainly be comfortable. We could certainly feel comfortable saying, yes, this is definitely not something to do. But anything that's like giving the go ahead, you know, that is not our place to do. And so we've had questions like this in the past. We even answered a question like this on an episode. And then after the fact, we decided that it wasn't our place to answer that type of question. And we've removed it before putting it on the air. So, you know, I don't want this to come across as like two white guys being like, Morrissey's racism is not a big enough deal. Listen to him if you want. Like, I think it's totally valid to get rid of Morrissey. But I guess it's more kind of like, we understand that so much media, so much music is problematic and just not good in so many ways. And so exercising all of those things out of your life can sometimes be an exercise in futility. Not that you shouldn't try and do it, but I guess it's sort of, you're going to have to, we're just saying you need to pick and choose where you think that that is going to be. And I think it's totally valid to draw a hard line and say you don't want to support any of it. But I also think that I don't want to get into the game where I'm giving someone a hard time for, say, liking Morrissey, because so many people that I am a fan of, you could probably dig deep and find some stuff that's not so great. So I don't know. It's a sticky situation, but I think that, like, overall, if people send us these emails and these types of questions, you're never going to get a go-ahead from us. And, you know, one time I was asking a person of color if a shirt I was thinking about putting out was cultural appropriation or if it just was crossing a certain line. And, you know, a lot of people said, no, it's totally fine. But this person said, you know, if you have to ask the question, it's probably better to not do it. So I feel like it's good to err on the side of caution in many regards with these types of issues. So I know I've been rambling for a while here, but I guess all of this is just to say, you know, for me personally, I think Morrissey seems like kind of a turd. And I don't really think that he is worth supporting, but you hear this hesitation in our voices just because we know and feel the complexity of these things and how all of our personal emotions can really get tied up into art that we love. And, you know, at very early on, I think episode maybe 4 or 5, we put our stake in the ground, said we don't believe in hero worship. So I don't believe in dismissing the things that Morrissey's done. I think ultimately, if you are going to be a fan of Morrissey, you need to sort of vocally and actively be pushing back against what he does. I think that, you know, that's sort of the middle ground to be found there, is to acknowledge those things vocally and often when Morrissey does come up. And I know these things aren't easy, but I feel like if you're still going to love someone that you know is pretty outwardly problematic, you got to hold their feet to the fire constantly.
Well put, Andy, as usual. So our next question comes in from Adrian Y, who emailed in. When adopting an animal from a shelter, should someone support a no-kill shelter or save an animal from a kill shelter, even though they don't want to fund their operation at all? In terms of funding, I'd rather support a no-kill shelter, which I know can also be done by donating, but not everyone can, and it's besides the point here. But the urgency of saving a life which might otherwise be lost is obviously important. What do you think?
So this is something I hadn't really thought about prior to this question coming in. I know it's sort of, for a lot of people, it's like, well, obviously you'd want to support the no-kill shelter, though I had seen documentaries that kind of examine that, and animals in no-kill shelters don't necessarily have the best lives. But I think as far as if your goal is to save a life, if you are adopting from a no-kill shelter, you are saving that animal. And if you adopt from a kill shelter, you're saving that animal that would have been killed. However, most animal shelters, kill, no-kill, the county shelter and whatever, have relationships with each other. So if you adopt from a no-kill shelter, that makes space for an animal that would have probably otherwise gone to a kill shelter to then go to the no-kill shelter. So you're still saving a life, albeit a little less directly. Does that make sense so far, Paul?
Yes. So you're kind of saving two lives almost by adopting from a no-kill shelter.
Potentially, but you know, I've only volunteered with one no-kill shelter, and what I learned from that experience was they are there to take in animals that are adoptable. You know, their goal is not to provide permanent housing for these animals. Their goal is to, you know, turn over animals so they can take in more animals. So less desirable, and that could be dogs that are older or have like a physical disability or something that would make them more work for their companion. Those animals often don't make it into no-kill shelters. They go to the kill shelter. So I think you could also look at it as being more noble to take in an animal from a kill shelter because those animals are less likely to get adopted in general. That being said, I think the most important thing in any of this is making sure that you get an animal that fits you and your situation, your lifestyle. You know, if you're living in a city and maybe it's not best to get a dog that needs to be running around in fields all day long, or maybe you need to get a dog that does well with cats, like whatever it might be. Like you want, I think probably the most important thing is finding an animal that, you know, fits those things so that you don't find yourself having to, you know, find someone else to take this animal from you because they're such a bad fit with your life. So I think that that's important. I think that either way, whichever way you go, you're going to be saving a life. You're either going to directly save the life or you're going to make room for an animal to come from a no-kill shelter or to come from a kill shelter. So I feel like there's not a big enough difference that you should have to like feel upset about picking one over the other. And even though you said it was beside the point, I do think it's like if you have the ability to donate, adopt from the kill shelter and donate to the no-kill shelter is certainly a really good option as well to support both. But in general, you're going to save a life either way, and I think that either one has its pluses, and there's not really a lot of minuses. So whichever dog you think is good for you at whatever situation, as long as they're adopted, go for it.
I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Fair enough. All right. Jennifer L., to finish off Jennifer's email, writes in via email, "I was vegetarian for 13 years before going vegan a little over a year ago. Now my main interest is veganism, meaning I read books, listen to podcasts and webinars, visit websites about vegan topics, and little else. I'm starting to feel like I only want vegan friends and enjoy local meetup meals and book discussions. Should a vegan stay in organizations, professional, religious, social, that they are not really interested in anymore for the sake of advocacy? I can't convert someone to veganism who's already a vegan at a vegan meetup, but it is difficult to keep going to other things where you're considered a bit odd and make no progress on making more vegans. Do you leave these organizations and their meat-eating functions, or do you hang about hoping you are planting a seed that will someday take root and grow?" So, this is a good question.
It is a good question. Can I give my thoughts on it, Andy?
Please do.
All right. I would say... Do the things that you want to do and figure out the way that you are going to best advocate for animals. So if staying in these organizations that you really don't want to be in anymore is going to be like taxing on you, taxing on your mental health, if it's, if you're just going to be really uninterested and bored in them, you know, I would say it's probably not worth it. And you probably could find a different way, of advocating for animals that is something that you more enjoy. Like, I don't know, like, writing stuff for websites or leafleting or like really a bunch of other stuff. But like, I would say find the thing if you are interested in, cause obviously you said like, oh, should I do this just for the sake of advocacy? I would say no, because there are many different ways you can effectively advocate for animals. And I am sure that you could find something that you would be more interested in. And now I do think there's benefit in just being a vegan in a place and just having people who aren't vegan exposed to vegans and being exposed to vegan food and being exposed to like friendly dialogue about this kind of stuff and constructive dialogue about this kind of stuff. Like there's definitely benefit in that, but I don't think that's necessarily for everyone. And I don't think you should have to force yourself to do that.
Yeah, and think about how good of an advocate are you going to be if you're in a situation where you're miserable. You know, you're likely not going to influence others and make them go, I want to be like this person, if you're just kind of going through the motions and you're really miserable in what you're doing. You know, you're more likely to sustain your vegan advocacy when you find that thing that you like to do. I think the middle ground is finding your vegan community, going to the meetups, and you know, while you look for other things to do, you can still stay there, but I wouldn't feel like you have to be there for the sake of advocacy, because that type of advocacy that's like a long con, you know, that's not like a quick, it's not a quick in out. That's like, you're in it to win it for a very long time before you start to see the fruits of your advocacy grow there. So, if it's something you're miserable in, I say, get out.
All right.
Okay, so we got a really lengthy email from Jade, so thank you, Jade, for that. We're going to pick and choose some little parts of it. Jade kind of started by saying that they thought we really underplayed the importance of the environmental aspect of veganism, you know, essentially kind of saying climate change will affect us all. And so it's like, no matter, Jade didn't say this specifically, but I kind of take from that, like, well, no matter how much we're advocating for everything else, if the world is destroyed if we're all underwater because of global warming, that's not going to do anyone any good. And then also just sort of talked about the classist, racist aspects of those things, because the people who are the most affected by climate change are the ones who are the poorest in communities of color. And usually those are the people that are contributing the least to climate change. So, to that regard, I would say very good point, Jade. So to that end, I think that we should place a lot of importance on the environmental aspects of it. And I think Paul, you and I kind of downplay it a little bit in terms of advocacy, just because we don't think of it as a huge motivating factor. And we've explored that in a number of episodes, but obviously for some people it is. And perhaps we need to spend more time explaining why people should care about the environment as far as it's going to affect us and our futures on this planet. So anyway, Jade goes on to say that they are very concerned with the amount of plastic in veganism, and you know, especially with vegan products that everyone purchases. And so Jade says, I'm just wondering if either of you have any thoughts on how to make veganism still as tasty but with less disposable plastic. Do you care about the amount of disposable plastic waste you create in daily life? And is there anything you do to try and minimize this? So I have a couple of things that I do. Paul, do you have anything that you do in this regard?
I probably don't do as much as I should. As much as possible, I won't buy like water bottles. I just carry around my, albeit my plastic water bottle that I reuse. And I only have two of those that I pretty much just have used for a few years now. So it's like, I try not to buy like plastic water bottles and those sorts of things. I try to recycle, I guess. I do not do that much. No, I will fully admit that I should probably be doing more with this.
Yeah, I can certainly be doing more as well. As many listeners know, I live a van dwelling lifestyle, and I'm trying to cut down on the amount of waste that I create. it's not as easy as someone who can, you know, have mason jars full of dried beans that they get from a local market. But certain things that I do to minimize what I do is I do have reusable water bottles that I try and fill up as much as I possibly can. I also have a couple of sporks like that are intended for camping that I keep with me. So I'll often end up at like a Whole Foods and make a salad at the hot bar or the cold bar, as it were. And I just noticed that I was like, every day I'm just throwing out a container and I'm throwing out a fork. And so I started carrying my own in that regard. And you could also, most Whole Foods actually have plates that you can use and return to them instead of using any of their cartons or, you know, disposable plates that they have. So those are two things that I do. And obviously everyone can be doing more, but I find that to be a really helpful little thing that really adds up over time. And just start carrying some reusable utensils with you. Even if you go to like a fast casual place, often they're giving you a plastic fork with your mac and cheese, whatever it might be.
That's interesting. I gotta get me one of those.
Yeah, it's great. You can get a plastic, I know it's plastic, but you can get a plastic one for like $3, or you can get a metal one for like $10, and they're pretty great. And then Jade went on to ask, what about clothing? You know, what ways can we have less of an impact with our clothing? And this was off of a discussion in an episode where we were talking about the environmental impact of cotton and even organic cotton. Not so great. You know, most, you know, the fashion industry in general, not great for the planet. So, Paul, I don't know what suggestions you have, but I will start off by saying that buying secondhand is obviously always great. Unfortunately, I think we also have to recognize that certain people, secondhand is not accessible in certain regards. So for me as a large guy, I had a wedding that Paul and I attended, and I had to get a suit in a specific color in my size, which is not a size that's carried at like a Macy's or something. So I wasn't able to just stroll into a store and pick up whatever. And, you know, a lot of secondhand stores don't carry suits, let alone my size. So that was like a situation where I was like, I have to buy this thing new. So we do need to recognize the limits of those things, but I think we all could certainly be buying more secondhand clothing. Another thing that is important to note is that the footprint of clothing is bigger in the care aspect of it than the actual purchasing of the materials. So we always focus on organic and this and that, but actually the washing of your clothes is what causes the biggest impact. So something that I do is I make sure as much as possible to rewear clothing. And, you know, this is obviously, I can stretch it a little more than some people can because I go days at a time without seeing people that I know and don't necessarily care for wearing the same thing or if it's a little stinky. But, you know, washing your clothes less and then making sure that you have a full load when you do go to wash them, that actually is something that can really minimize the amount of, you know, the footprint of your clothing. And if you do have to buy new, obviously, it's best to look for organic. It's best to look for sweatshop free. And more importantly, most importantly, perhaps, buy things that are built to last and things that you will want to wear beyond one fashion season. Because, you know, fast fashion is not great for our planet. So don't buy something if it's like just for, oh, this will be great for this like summer and then I'm going to like throw it away. And again, buying sweatshop free, buying organic, there are limits to that. You know, those things tend to be more expensive as well. So
do you have any examples of companies that perhaps create organic and sweatshop free t-shirts, Mandy?
Nothing comes to mind right now, Paul.
All right.
Okay. Jade's email goes on. I know this is a long episode. We're getting there. Got a couple more questions. Jade's email goes on to say, sometimes my veganism and environmentalism collide. For example, almond milk. It's delicious, but has a high environmental cost to make. Personally, I choose to drink soy, but when I try to encourage friends to eat more vegan friendly, I don't know what to say when they're like, I now drink heaps of almond milk, as I obviously don't want them to go back to cow's milk, or think I am not proud of them for trying to consume less animal products. But at the same time, I want them to know not all milk alternatives have the same cost environmentally. Thoughts? So, Paul, I think this kind of harkens back to our conversations about how much is too much to pile on to someone. You know, we've talked about, like, if you're getting someone to go vegan, but then you're like, hey, also check the Food Empowerment Project list and don't get palm oil and check the sugar and, you know, like all these things. And we worry about it being too much. So that kind of feels like it's in that realm. Like, how would you handle that kind of situation?
I mean, I think it's the type of thing where it's like, you know how far you can push your friends and your family. So it might be the type of thing where, like, if it's possible, like, you can maybe, like, if you're buying something for them, like if you're buying a drink or a coffee or something for them, be like, hey, can I buy this drink for you? Like, do you mind if we get soy milk instead of almond milk? Because soy milk is more environmentally friendly. And it's like, you can kind of throw something in there, like sprinkle the education in there. Hopefully it'll stick. And just you being around them and being like a positive influence on them, I think can go a long way as well. So just maybe encouraging them to, you know, keep being vegan, but also trying to be a positive role model in these other aspects as well.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind that cow's milk will always be way worse than even almond milk. And I was, in preparation for this, I was kind of looking up to see if there are any convenient resources that compare the impact of everything, and didn't find anything that had super conclusive answers on that. But, you know, it's more than just the water that goes into the almonds. It's the waste that is coming from the cows and the methane and, you know, everything involved with animal agriculture goes into that milk as well. So, you know, keep that in mind. Don't feel horrible if you can't get your friends to switch over to what you deem is the most environmentally friendly milk alternative out there. And like you were saying, Paul, it's like, you know how to talk to your friends. So to me, in regards to any of these sort of extracurricular, you know, vegan things like chocolate and bananas and coffee and whatever it might be, those are the things where you just kind of know when it's time. Like, you know, if you feel like it's too much for them right off the bat, I think it's okay to hold back on those things. And then as you feel like they're becoming more secure with being vegan, then you can start to introduce these other issues. But, you know, they might be someone that's like, I want to do everything right now. So it just depends on the friend.
Cool.
All right. Let's get to the final piece of Jade's email, which reads, what would your advice for an introverted vegan be to be an effective advocate? I guess I am still pretty new to veganism, but I have never really been one of those people to post on Facebook about anything really, and I use it mostly to keep in touch with old friends. I would hate to have them all block me because I have become the annoying vegan friend. In terms of advocating in person, I have had lots of conversations about being vegan, but I usually stick to the positives of being vegan and tend to steer clear of the negatives of using animal products to avoid putting the person in that awkward place, which is probably necessary to convince them to go vegan. I think this is a great question, but I guess before you answer it, Paul, are you an introvert?
I think I'm in this like weird in-between place where it's like I don't really like ever being the center of attention, like, and I don't like having attention put on me in situations where like it wasn't clear that I was going to be the center of attention. And even then it's like I usually don't have like having a lot of attention put on me, but then again, I'm also like a teacher. So it's like, I have to have attention on me. I strive to have full attention on me all day. But I would say I probably have more introverted tendencies than extroverted.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I feel like I'm a bona fide introvert in that I need mucho alone time to recharge. But do you have advice for this person? For Jade?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of specific things, but I really think it's like finding your thing, finding the thing that works for you where you're still able to advocate for veganism. It's like, maybe it's writing blog posts or something like that, where it's like, you don't necessarily have to directly interact with people through conversations. You can just kind of like create material and put it out there, and to be exposed to people and not necessarily like having to have this back and forth communication if that's not your thing. So I think it's just really about figuring out the best thing for you, the thing that works for you and the thing that you feel good, like the thing that you feel good, like you do it and you're like, wow, I feel like I'm really doing something good. I feel like I'm making the world a better place by doing this, and you're also comfortable doing it because then it's going to be sustainable and you're going to be able to keep doing it, versus some form of advocacy that every time you do it, you're like, God, this is like so difficult for me. This feels so I'm so uncomfortable. It's causing a lot of anxiety. It's like, that's something that's not really sustainable. So, you know, just figuring out your thing. And there's, you know, with the internet and stuff, there are tons of different things that you can do, I think, that are good for introverts who might not necessarily want to, you know, get out there and be like yelling and marching and stuff like that.
Yeah, you know, as the saying goes, it takes all kinds. So there tends to be high value placed on extroverts. I actually just started reading a book all about the world of introverts. And it's explaining that right now about how so much importance is placed on that type of, you know, person in the United States, at least, and I'm sure elsewhere in the world as well. But, you know, you are going to know what's best for you to do. You know, as far as like the Facebook stuff goes, I am not someone that likes to post stuff on Facebook constantly. And we've talked about this a bunch. And there's been times when we've talked about an article and we've said, hey, this is a great article to post if you're not someone that posts a lot of vegan stuff all the time. Like the milk recall, I think, was the most recent one. So mm-hmm. I think if you find an article that isn't like, hey, if you eat meat, you're a fucking asshole, you know, find something that's like, hey, look at the environmental impact, you know, stuff like that, that doesn't feel like as much of a personal attack, especially since the environment is your thing. And it would make sense that that's a topic that you would be posting about. I think sprinkling those in, like, just try one and see what happens. And you can even preface it with, like, I know this is a touchy subject, but I've been doing a lot of research and I think it's important, or, you know, like, whatever it is, like, make it personal, make people realize why you're posting it. Those things I find can help, instead of just like straight up posting an article and be like, hey, if you meet, you're a horrible person type thing. But I think there's something to be said for pushing yourself out of your comfort zone a little bit. But as someone that never wants to talk to anyone ever, you know, I make vegan t-shirts, that's my living, but I almost never wear the shirts that are like really going to invite a conversation. I wear the ones that are pretty low key, because for me, it would add more stress in my day to get stopped by random strangers that are wanting to talk to me about veganism when I'm not in like the zone to talk about it.
Thank you, Andy. We're moving on. Is this the last one?
This is the last question.
This is a whopper though. So Meredith writes in. Is this the same Meredith as before?
Sure is.
Thank you, Meredith, for posing these wonderful questions. Meredith writes in. A few months ago, my husband and I were out for drinks with my brother and his wife, who were in town. She had a couple drinks and started laying into me about being vegan. She was clearly very defensive and unwilling to examine her own life. She said, "What about that diamond on your finger? Don't you think it's a blood diamond and human slaves excavated that? Are you saying that an animal's life and well-being is more important than a human's?" She caught me totally off guard, and I honestly didn't know what to say. The whole conversation has really weighed on me. I feel like George Costanza, who can't come up with a comeback on the spot, but figures one out later. Haha. Anyway, I know that choosing compassion over cruelty at every meal is a no-brainer, and that to live in this world of ours, there is no way to be 1,000% vegan, given that practically every construction material has some animal matter in it. Should we not drive on roads? Of course we should, but how does one articulate to someone that though there are many injustices and social justice issues in the world, being vegan has the biggest impact on a daily basis? Should a vegan not wear diamond jewelry? What about mined metals like silver, etc.? The list goes on. What would you have said as a comeback to my sister-in-law?
So this is an attitude that I think every vegan has encountered at some point, which is people play this game where they want to find something that you're doing wrong and then use it as a reason to negate your veganism and veganism in general. And, you know, it's a defense mechanism. It's a way of making themselves feel better about what they're doing. And you're not this 1,000% perfect holy being. You make mistakes. So who are you to judge me? You know, because people feel judged for eating animals, even if you're not saying anything about it, just your mere presence there. People will often feel judged because of it. As to the issue of diamonds and mined metals and silver, I think, yeah, people shouldn't wear those things. There's a lot of horrible stuff that goes along with that. That doesn't negate veganism, but I do think vegans, we tend to fall into this trap where we think we're doing so much good that it kind of gives us a free pass on these things. You know, I often hear people say, I took an hour-long super hot shower because I'm vegan. I save so much water. You know, my shower pales in comparison to what we eat as a hamburger. And it's like, you should probably still take a reasonable shower, 5 or 10 minutes, whatever it might be. You know, just because you're doing something good elsewhere, it doesn't give you a free pass to do harm somewhere else, even if it's like way less harm. But I also think that it's important to call out that flawed, you know, logical fallacy when people try to use it. You know, you could respond with, you know what, you're right, blood diamonds are a big issue. That wasn't something that I was aware of when I got this ring. I may have made a different choice now, but I have it. I'm not throwing it away. And, you know, that doesn't take away from the fact that it's wrong to harm animals. Like, oh, you think that because I have this diamond that you should intentionally inflict suffering on animals? Those two things are not related in their cause, and one doesn't, you know, give you a free pass for the other.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to say. And I just wanted to also add that I totally relate to this situation because I am 100% not the type of person that can come up with like witty comebacks or come up with responses to tough questions like this on the spot. So I'm totally the same way, which is why, coincidentally, I try to talk around Andy's questions that he poses to me so much, because sometimes I'm just not great at coming up with something on the spot, which does not make for good podcasting. But yeah, I mean, I think Andy covered it pretty much. I would say something along the same lines that And I really love, and I've been using the Andy's like compassion is not or compassion is a renewable resource line, where it's like you can just getting across that it's like you can care about more than one thing, even if they're not related to each other, and you can work towards caring about different things at the same time. It's like no one's perfect, but we're all trying to be better people.
Yeah, and like when someone's doing this, they're making veganism about you. They're not making veganism about the animals. And that, you know, that's a fallacy that gets presented time and time and time again. And so, I mean, you could just in that instance be like, "Oh, so you think because I have this diamond that you have to kill animals?" Something like that. You know, along those lines, just to try and mine out, you know, where their head is at and just sort of put them on the spot a little bit and see what they say. I think that, you know, unless you've had this history of constantly judging that person and telling them how horrible they are as a person, that they wouldn't really have, you know, anything to stand on in that regard.
Agreed.
All right. With that said, Paul, I think it's the bottom of the mailbag.
The bottom of the mailbag?
The bottom of the mailbag.
Oh, okay. I got you. Also, unrelated, I got an email from Veg News the other day, and it was like, vegan banh mi, and I was like, oh, Andy would love this.
Yes, I would. So let me say that these are not all of the emails and comments that we got. As the show has been growing, it's been harder for us to include everything. Some questions had kind of very similar themes, and you know, we had to sort of pick and choose. So we apologize if we did not get to your question. Almost anything that we get, we will respond to via email if we don't get to it in the podcast. But thank you all very much for all of your very thoughtful questions. People send us some real conundrums, and people really have opened up to us in some pretty deep ways in the emails that we get. And it's certainly humbling to Paul and I to, you know, to have people trust us, to have you trust us with your issues like this, and to put so much value in our often misinformed, half-baked opinions.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you so much. We really, really appreciate it. And we really appreciate all the support and all the stuff, the kind words and positive reviews that you've sent us, and the critiques and the criticisms as well, because that's how we become better people. And better podcasters.
Yes. Speaking of reviews and critiques, feel free to go ahead and give us that iTunes review or rating, you know, or both. If you're feeling like it, we definitely appreciate those things as well. Thank you to everyone that's been doing that.
I got nothing else. Andy, what do you got coming up?
Oh, Paul.
Yes, Andy?
I will be at the Vegan Street Fair pushing my Compassion Company wares. That is March 26th in Los Angeles, California. And then April 1st, I'll be at the Texas Veg Fest in Austin, Texas. April 8th and 9th, I'll be at the Nashville Veg Fest in Nashville, Tennessee. April 29th, I'll be at the Indy Veg Fest in Indianapolis, Indiana. And then April 30th, I'll be at the Michigan Veg Fest in Novi, Michigan. There is a bunch of other dates that I'll be at. You can find all of those at CompassionCo.com.
All right.
Paul, before we finish the show.
Yeah?
We have one last letter.
Oh, what? Right at the bottom of the bag. We had to almost missed it.
Right at the bottom of the bag. A physical letter that has been mailed to me in my van is addressed to me from me asking you to say these seven words.
We are the Bearded Vegans, signing off.
Long gone, like a turkey through the cone. Long gone, like a turkey through the cone. Long gone, with my long pajamas on. Whoa, look a yon. What I see, that red-eyed captain there, boys, he's coming after me. I'm long gone, like a turkey through the, long gone, like a turkey through the, long gone, with my long pajamas on.
Hold on, there's sirens driving by. I'm like in an alley between a Planet Fitness and a CVS.
Perhaps there are people who dress up their dogs in regalia that is exploitative. I don't know why I have so much trouble with that word.
Exploitive?
Exploitative? Exploited? Exploitative, right?
I don't know.
Exploitative? There's two T's.
Yeah.
I think it's
exploitative?
Exploitative?
I don't know. None of them sound right anymore.
All right, whatever. I'm saying it. Satan.
Wow.
Wow. So,
Owen Wilson, is that you?